I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. One of the more fascinating books I've seen this season is Adventures in Memory, The Science and Secrets of Remembering and Forgetting. It looks at how memory works, how we remember, and how we forget. It also illuminates the basic premise of what memory is. It is written by two Norwegian sisters, Hilde Ottsby, a writer and editor, and Ylva Ottsby, a clinical neuropsychologist who is the vice president of the Norwegian Neuropsychological Society. They're both from Oslo, Norway, but spoke to me about 8 weeks ago while they were both in Pittsburgh. This book is published by Greystone Books. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Hilde Ottsby. Good morning, Ms. Ottsby.
Hey.
And Ylva Ottsby, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. I should like to begin with Ylva. What compelled the two of you to work together on this book?
Well, we wanted to show readers how memory works and how it doesn't work so that people perhaps could get a better idea of what to expect from memory and show a little bit of humility when it comes to what memory can and can't do for us.
Yeah, and, right? and that's the thing, too, about in reading the book, the humility. I mean, I guess people in general, human beings in general, lack that often. When we start to say, have challenges to our memory, we tend to say, I don't know, hide those, don't we?
Yeah, and people desperately want to have better memory and improve their memory, and yeah, people get kind of allured by this idea of having a super memory, and that is not going to happen. However many memory techniques that you learn, you're not going to be able to remember everything in your life.
Hilde, a lot of our memories are from our own storytelling. And so I'm curious to know, is there a difference, say, between identity and memory? A lot of us, I guess, think that they're the same thing, are they?
Yeah, one of the most surprising things for me when we started working with this book, and I learned so much about memory through this, but the first things that surprised me was that personality isn't memory. We cannot measure personality on what you remember from your life because that varies and it's also unreliable. So what you test in a personality test is how you respond to the world and how you process the world. And of course, our memories and our life stories is very important to our identity, and we got something called kernel memories, which is kind of the most important events in our life that defines us deeply. Still, that isn't our personality.
Yeah, and the other thing, too, that struck me as I'm reading the book is that we forget a lot that's good, and at the same time, some of us tend to forget the bad, but those two things, we don't, there's some things we don't have control over. I mean, there's some bad things that we ought to forget, say, but can't, and there are good things that we should remember, but can't as well.
Yeah, well, it's possible to kind of turn that a little bit around because, of course, you can work to try and remember the good stuff more than the bad. You can just try and focus on small little details that you like in your life and that you discover every day to make your mindset a little bit different. Mm-hmm. So it is possible to kind of shift that weight a little bit by a conscious effort.
Yeah, and so do you think, I guess that's the one thing that I got out of this book, is that with some effort, you can. What are some of the tricks, say, or some of the habits that one should take so that they can improve their memories?
Yes, so there are some techniques that people can use in order to memorize stuff that they want to remember. For instance, shopping lists and cue cards for their exams, for instance. These are very, very well-known techniques like memory palace, like where you use a route through your house or through your neighborhood that you know very well, mm-hmm. and then you put various items along that route in your memory and combine that with something that is very visual and stands out. But yet, these techniques are not possible to use in the same way on your personal memories. So what you were asking was, how can we remember more of these positive events in our lives and remember more of the negative ones? And I think Hilde gave the answer, which was to kind of be more mindful of the experiential details of memories and kind of be more in the memories.
Also talk
about memories together.
As a neuroscientist, is there in the course of your research and as well as writing this book, is there a finite space for our memories? I mean, we'll talk in a second about what's good about forgetfulness, but I'm curious to know, because some people can remember more than others. I'm wondering, do they have, say, a bigger hard drive in their head?
Well, that is a really great mystery, I think. One of the biggest mysteries in memory research that we haven't solved yet, and that is that there seems to be an infinite space for memories, and still there seems to be advantage in sorting out and getting rid of memories as well. So when people who remember vast amounts of their lives, when they encode their memories and store them, we don't really know what is going on and what makes that possible and why everyone can't have that kind of memory. So I think that is just really, really fascinating.
And here's another dumb question, Ylva. Is memory itself kept in the brain? I mean, certain smells, certain touches, you know, can trigger certain memories, and I'm wondering, it surely can't just be in the brain, can it?
Well, yes, it is the brain that stores these sensory details for memories. Mm. So memories of sense and touch and smell and vision and everything is stored in the brain, where the brain also interprets these sensory experiences. So when you, for instance, feel a smell and that reminds you of your childhood, for instance, what happens is that the smell memory is the cue to a larger memory network, which it is tightly connected to. So that will reactivate part of that memory network in your brain and kind of throw you back to your past.
What's fascinating in reading the book is how the two of you work so well together in terms of bringing different aspects of all of this in a book that's eminently readable and enjoyable in many parts. Hilde, the perspective that each of you provide in the book, I mean, I guess that was important for you that was an important thing to have in mind as you were writing the book. How did you guys work together?
We were sitting next to each other in a coffee house in Oslo and writing it.
Uh-huh.
Wrote it totally together. We came with different things.
Uh-huh.
We're having different kind of ideas for what we could do. I worked as a journalist for many years, so very funny when Ylva were telling me about experiments, like the chess experiment or the divers experiment that we are going to look. When she told me about those, I was like, yeah, but we have to do them. We have to do them ourselves because it would be so much fun to replicate them and it would be a very visual thing to describe in the book and we can talk to people in that experiment.
Yeah, and so in terms of, because you are siblings, does one have, say, a better memory than the other?
No, I think we have equally poor memories.
But are there certain things from, say, childhood that one remembers better than the other?
I'm 4 years senior of Ylva, so of course there are things I remember better than her and different than her. But overall we remember.
Yeah, it's fascinating to see how two different people remember one thing. And so when we think of memory and how it works, I mean, we've been hearing a lot about false memories in recent weeks and months. What happens in terms of say, what happens in our heads in terms of the creating of those false memories?
So whenever two people remember the same event, it might shift slightly over the years, mm-hmm. because every time we remember something, we reconstruct it based partly on the memory traces that are laid down in our brains, and together with our imagination that fills in the gaps so that we can remember something more smoothly without having to stick to all these details in our mind. So this is a natural process that affects all our memories, but sometimes memories can be entirely false, and that is when we remember something that never actually happened at all.
And so in the book you also talk about cumulative memory. I'll get you to explain that, I mean, because it seems for people listening to us that it's the same thing as a false memory. Or it's similar, I should say, but yeah. They're not. Is that right?
Yes. So when we write about a cumulative memory, it's kind of the average of all the times we've experienced similar events that are kind of put together into one memory that kind of gives us the same experience. And in a way, it's the same process as when we have a false memory, because it is a reconstruction based on all these different instances. But that doesn't mean that it hasn't happened. It's just that all memories have this kind of element of false memory to it, which is a natural part of remembering.
And we do change our memories, don't we, if we have, say, a videotape or an audio tape of an experience. That can shape one's memory of something just as much as, say, another person's recollection.
Yeah, if we have, if we see ourselves in a videotape, for instance, that could definitely alter the way we remember it ourselves. And you may have noticed yourself that you sometimes see yourself from the outside in your mm-hmm. memory. Mm-hmm. And that is, of course, that could come from seeing yourself in a photograph or in a video, but it also happens to memories that are not videotaped or photographed. So that's just another example of how reconstructive memory is.
So, Hilde, we're living in the Me Too era, and a lot of memories are surfacing again for people. What's happening in our brains when we contend with something that we're trying to bury away, something that we're trying to forget? And when these things do come back, what are some of the challenges to these memories in terms of how other people perceive them, say?
Traumatic memories. We have dedicated a whole chapter for that mm-hmm. in our book, because they can control people's lives so much, and it can damage a person for the rest of their lives yeah. that they're fighting these memories. And in our, it's two ways, or kind of two attitudes towards traumatic memories. And in the one end of the scale, some researchers say that you can repress memories, and that it will create all of these kind of other problems based on these repressed memories. But in our book, we state that you cannot have repressed memories, but because one of the first laws of memory is that if something is exceptional and highly emotional, then you have to remember it. It's so strong. It clings to your memory much stronger than other stuff, kind of boring stuff, you know. So, but of course, that doesn't mean that people can't kind of store a story like that away in the closet and just keep that story out of the rest of their life story, because it's a disturbance and something that kind of is difficult to handle. So, but that doesn't mean that people forget them. And they did this research on people that where it was proven that they had been molested, and years after, a researcher contacted them and asked them, and pretended to ask mainly about something else, but also asked them if they ever had forgotten being molested, and all of the participants in that research said that they never ever forgot. But that doesn't mean that you cannot store it away, hide it away, and kind of try to forget. That is what most people would want to do, because it's so horrible, right?
Yeah. And so how do you think our courts or our policing, or say, I don't know, the Senate Judiciary Committee in the United States should do better in terms of understanding how memory works? I mean, there's a certain gap there, and isn't there, in terms of how they're contending with memory?
Yeah, well, we write about that in a book, too. It's a wonderful researcher called Elizabeth Loftus, who did all this research on false memories and made all these experiments where she showed how unreliable memory is and how we reconstruct, right? We can. It's very easy to change a memory, especially under very traumatic circumstances, mm-hmm. because the one thing you remember that is important, that is the one thing that has kind of, that made you afraid. You don't remember the color of people's shoes or their shoelaces or, you know, how, what brand the dress they were mm-hmm. was. That isn't what you remember in that situation. You're very scared and under a lot of kind of emotional pressure. So what you remember is a perpetrator, right? That mm-hmm. is what you need to remember. And in the court system in the U.S., they are much more aware of this now. It also set off, her research set off a whole new way of teaching police in Britain and in Norway. We also met this Canadian firefighter, and he was very familiar with how memory works under pressure. And he knew how to investigate and interrogate and take memory's flaws into consideration. Mm-hmm. So it is being, you know, in a hearing that we just witnessed, that isn't kind of part of the system, but it's yeah. more and more part of the system. The police and firefighters, obviously, then, are working knowing about these rules, yeah. even though not everyone does, and it's not perfect yet. And, of course, jurors has to be taught about how memory works again and again, because it's normal people. And hopefully they read our book, and then they will understand more that a person that doesn't remember the color of the clothes of someone that attacked them is an unreliable witness.
Right.
That is a normal witness.
Mm-hmm. So, Ylva, as a neuroscientist, I'm curious to know, in the course of writing the book, or did you come away with things that you didn't know before?
Yes, absolutely. I got this whole new perspective on all of memory research, and I think what has been most wonderful about writing a book like this is to see how memory research spans so many fields of study, from the neurobiology and the molecular level up until the societal level and literature. So that has been a wonderful eye-opener, I think.
The other thing that struck me as I'm talking to you now and having read the book, it's funny how memory works in that sense, because I read the book several days ago, put it away, and then came back to it last night in preparing for our chat. Certain things I forgot that are worth discussing, and something that just triggered me as I was talking to Hilda is that memory problems are a lot more common than we'd like to admit, and we tend to take it for granted in terms of, say, something that happens when we grow older. But injuries, for example, and major and minor injuries can contribute to how memory works and how it can fail at times.
Yes, and I think that is also something that I would like to highlight, that memory problems is something that affects young people as well as old people, and that we need to be more aware of this, and in terms of trying to help young people who have been in accidents or who suffer from epilepsy or ADHD or depression, and kind of help them function better in society with their memory problems.
Did you get a chance to work with your sister often?
At least now we are working a lot together, talking about our book and having this wonderful opportunity.
Yeah, and it must be great as you travel, as you are, that you're able to cultivate, say, new memories, especially as adults, as opposed to, say, when you were children.
Yes, definitely. There are some very different memories being formed now that we are adults and experiencing this travel together.
Yeah. I so appreciate talking to both of you today. I appreciate your time, and congratulations on this book. It's a eminently readable book and a great achievement. Thanks again.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
The book is called Adventures in Memory, The Science and Secrets of Remembering and Forgetting. It's published by Greystone. Ilva Otsby and Hilda Otsby join me on the line from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plato.